Hi, my name's Dave Farley, and welcome to the Engineering Room podcast, where we seek out influential and interesting people from the world of software. Some of the world's best developers and thinkers to pick their brains to discuss their ideas, and occasionally to challenge my own on what it takes for all of us to make better software faster. My guest today is one of the senior technical people at one of the most famous web companies. Niklas Gustafsson is Chief Architect and VP of Engineering at Spotify. Niklas, welcome to the Engineering Room.
Thank you. I'm very happy to be here. Looking forward to this discussion.
Great. We've been exchanging some information and I've been doing some background on you. And certainly one of the things that I've picked up is that at Spotify, you think of the way in which you organize things as fleet management.
It is one way, yeah. So I can go into more detail, but it's definitely one aspect that we've been focusing on over the last few years quite a bit.
Cool. So could you explain a little bit about what that means to you and why you think that's a useful model for thinking and organizing things?
Absolutely. Yeah. So maybe take a step back a little bit, reason quickly about Spotify's architecture, because that's an important framing for this, I think. So Spotify, we're now, I guess, 15 years old, and we started from the very beginning with what would now be called the microservice architecture. So we built all our software as smallish components with some amount of loose coupling between them. We made our mistakes on the way. I can talk about that if we're interested in it. But generally speaking, we have a pretty decoupled architecture. And that leads to us also having lots and lots and lots of components. So if you look at our and we apply this across the board, so not just for our backend services, but we apply the same architecture to our data pipelines or the way that we architect our mobile apps on the inside. Like, they're all broken down into these small components. But that leads to having many of those components. If you look at our backend alone, we have something like 3,000 different services in production. And if you plot that as a graph of like the growth of the number of components, it's been growing very quickly over the years at Spotify and outgrowing the number of developers with some margin, like a much higher growth of software than the number of engineers we have. And we think we intend for that to continue. Like, it's an important way for us to drive innovation, be able to try out new things. But of course, the flip side of that is that it leads to a lot of stuff to maintain over a longer period of time. So what we did a few years ago, or what we started a few years ago, and what we do call fleet management, is to shift our mindset around how we think about maintaining these components. So prior to this work, we would really view each component as its own thing. So you would have a very strong ownership model. So we would have a team, the thing that we call a squad. They would own a set of these components. The ownership would be very, very strong. Like, everything that happened to their, let's say, backend services would go through that team, would be approved by that team. So,
but let me just interrupt you. That's in terms of, for want of a better term, the kind of business direction of those parts of the system, as well as the technical direction, or those are separated?
No, that is absolutely right. So the team, yeah, the squad in our case, they own the full life cycle of the software that they build. So everything from the product strategy. So imagine you were the search team and you're faced with building a great search experience for the type of content we have. Yep. They are the team to figure out what does that product look like and the design and product strategy for that, and down to the tech strategy and roadmap, yeah, for that. And then, yeah, that goes all the way. So that goes to which software components do we need? How do we want to design those? We, of course, have a lot of guardrails for that, but and to building and operating those things, like the full life cycle from ideation to being on call 24/7 for your thing sits within the team. So that's been the model that we've been operating on since day one, more or less. And it's been, I'm going to say, surprisingly scalable for us. Like, we've grown from when I started 12 and a half years ago, we were a few small teams, and now we're hundreds of teams. And that, I mean, we made many changes on the way, but that core concept, core model has been pretty stable over the years and been working surprisingly well for us.
It's one of the things that I've thought about I think about microservices, and one of the anti-patterns that I see with teams professing to adopt microservices is missing that distributed nature of development, not just the system. So we are distributing development as distributing responsibility and decision making, as well as the technical components of the system. And that's really, to my mind, I don't know whether you would agree, but one of the key values of that is that scalability of development that you get as a result. By making these teams more autonomous, more responsible for every aspect, they have more freedom of movement, more freedom of action. They are able to respond to change much more effectively.
For us, that has certainly been the case. And I'm not here to argue that microservices is the perfect architecture for every use case. But for us,
sure,
Spotify has been lucky enough to grow very quickly throughout our lifetime. And for us, it's been a very powerful architecture and set of practices for that scalability and for maintaining the distributed action, the distributed aspect that you're mentioning. Of course, I should be clear, it's not that every team builds things completely willy-nilly. Like, it needs to fit into the larger company strategy and the larger product strategy. So there's some degree of alignment that is happening as well. But that, like, all of those day-to-day decisions that you take as part of building and evolving and maintaining your systems, that we've been able to keep pretty local in the team. And that, I think, is very powerful. And we've been able to see the flip side of this, because we have, as I said, we made our mistakes along the way, of course, and we've definitely ended up with cases where we built accidentally or not more monolithic architectures. We had our mobile apps be very heavily monolithic. We had parts of our backend be pretty monolithic, and we've gone through the pains of that and seen so now we need to do a ton of coordination between many different teams to ship our software, and we can see how painful that is compared to where we've been able to break things down into more of the microservices type of pattern. So for us, it's been a great model.
And but as I think you're kind of hinting at, like any other engineering decision, there are kind of trade-offs. So things that you have to manage. I assume that when you're talking about fleet management, that's part of what you're talking about is okay, you've got this distributed organization and technical infrastructure of small pieces. How do you kind of point those pieces in a coherent direction from a business point of view and from an organization-wide point of view?
Yeah, and how do you? So that's part of it. So we've really thought about this in a few different highly related strategies, but it's really down to standardizing your technology stack. So we within Spotify, this is called golden technologies. So yeah. I can talk more about that if we want to. Reduce the amount of fragmentation that we have in our technology ecosystem. And then that coupled with fleet management, where we started this discussion on really trying to automate as much of the management of or maintenance of those components as possible.
Yeah. There's two interesting things in there, I think. But I might be misremembering, so do correct me if I'm wrong, but my recollection of, one of the things that made Spotify visible to lots of people was the stuff that you guys published years ago with Henrik Nyberg's animations about your development process and so on. One of my recollections from that, and one of my recollections of the tapes from that, is that the technical choices in those forms, what language you're going to program a particular piece in, was a choice of the team at the time.
That was not necessarily the case. So we've always had some level of guidelines and guardrails. So if you go down to the programming language, for example, that's something that we've always been pretty strongly opinionated around. We've had a set of languages that we want our teams to use. And I would say over time, we've introduced more and more of those. Like, we've slowly moved our way up the stack in terms of where we want to standardize across the company. There's still you can make exceptions for that where there's a good reason for it, but then at least we want there to be a healthy discussion around that decision and have some accountability for the decision. But so it's not, there's a fair amount of guidelines. And the reason for that is really to have both nowadays for the automation reasons, and I can talk more about that, but also to have just have fluidity in the organizations. We can move ownership of components around in the org. We can change the org structure without, some team all of a sudden taking on something that is written in a language that they might not be familiar with or whatnot. And just being able to move, like have people have mobility within the organization so they can switch a team and they don't have to completely relearn the stack. So I think that's been mostly a good set choice for us, but it's definitely a trade-off, of course. Like it's
I would agree with that from my background, which is largely from not on your scale, but certainly in the realm of larger systems and larger teams, and so that flexibility of having the ability for people and pieces to move around the organization, I think is a valuable one to have. Where would you see the trade-offs between the full autonomy of every decision is made within the team and autonomy within some constraints, within some, I think you use the term guide rails. I would use the term guide rails anyway. So having some guide rails for that kind of decision making, I must admit I'm probably more in line with the guide rails than the full autonomy personally.
Yeah, I think I am as well, just to make my biases clear as well.
Yeah.
I don't know if this is a good classification, but like I would maybe think about it as you can have the accidental fragmentation where you make decisions based on, some individual's preference or experience from previous work life or whatever, that are not necessarily a better choice from a company strategy or like supporting the actual problem they're trying to solve. There's, in my experience, lots of that will go on unless you put some type of guardrails in place. And then you can have the intentional fragmentation where, so let me take an example from our world of when you write the backend service, most of Spotify's backend services are Java based since 10 years or so ago. And there are, of course, use specific cases or edge cases where Java might not be the best programming language for a specific type of problem that we're faced with. And then we have to make a trade-off between the needs of that specific problem and that specific domain versus the type of gains we can get from fleet management automation, for example, because we all of a sudden build a service in Rust because Rust is amazing to do transcoding or whatever it might be.
Mm-hmm.
That might be great for solving that problem, but that team is now stuck with maintaining a solution that is poorly supported by our infrastructure teams, will not get any of the automation we have in place because we do not support that that stack internally. So those are the types of trade-offs that we're faced with. And I wouldn't say they're super common. I think we've picked a set of technologies that fit, some 90-10 type of thinking, of by far most of the use cases we have should fit within the technology stacks that we standardize on. But we also acknowledge that there will be some percentage that will not. So if you go back and look at our Golden Technologies, which has been our program for driving a higher degree of standardization, the long-term target we have for that is to reach 85% adoption. And that is exactly to retain a certain buffer where we have these edge cases and we have a certain amount of experimentation and innovation going on so we can try out new technologies and whatnot. So we're not striving to get to 100% because we actually think that would be counterproductive to what we
want. I think that's an excellent point. And organizationally, part of the freedom that you want, if somebody invents the world's greatest programming language ever, you want somebody in your organization to be trying it out and using it so that you can find out how good it is and exactly. Start adopting it. So you need that room for innovation and discovery as a part of your strategy, I would assume.
Yeah. So going back to the autonomy, like the autonomy that we want our teams to have is really around what's your product strategy and aligning that with our overall strategy, of course. And within that, like, what are the software components you need to solve that problem, more so than reinventing the infrastructure that those components ends up being built on. Like, that's, we've standardized on the infrastructure level, but left a fair amount of flexibility on the application level. So that's roughly the thinking.
And I guess the other aspect of that is the nature of the decision making around those trade-offs. So I would put this in terms of, you know, an architect's or an engineer's perspective on these sorts of things. It has to be framed by the economic value of the choices that we make. You know, it would be dumb to, you know, if every developer was picking their own development language to pad their CVs, that would be a bad economic choice from Spotify's point of view. Yep. But some of these decisions need to be more strategic than that.
Yep, that is absolutely right. And Spotify, like many companies nowadays, also have a shared platform. We have a platform team that builds that internal platform for us on top of our cloud environment. And we want to, that is expensive. That is a big investment for us. And of course, we want to be able to deduplicate those investments as much as we can. So the fewer technology stacks we need to support internally, the better off we are. So, but again, it's a trade-off around those against those local domain-based needs that we have.
I'm very interested in that as well, of what you think the characteristics of a good platform are, rather than some of the more tactical things that I see in the wild. Platform is often used as an excuse of keeping, you know, oversimplifying things like cloud provisioning, you know, or whatever. So it seems to me that it's a bit more complicated than just repeating common patterns as part of a platform, although that's certainly part of it. Let me stop putting words in your mouth. How would you define the bound, you know, how do you identify good candidates for platforming? What's the thinking that you think that needs to go in? What are the considerations that go in to get to high value platforms that do what you said, which I think I've read in other places, you know, looking to reduce developer toil?
Yeah, so we very roughly think about our internal platforms in terms of either infrastructure platforms, so the things that you would run our software on, and then business platforms, which are more, you know, how we do reporting and the APIs that provides to Spotify developers, or how our commerce platform work and how that provides APIs. So I'm going to talk mostly about the infrastructure side, because I think that's primarily what you're talking about.
So,
maybe to expand a little bit on what I said before. So first of all, we are in public clouds. We get a lot of the, let's say, lower level pieces coming out of our cloud provider. So including, you know, we used to be in our own data centers. We used to build and operate our own databases and our own storage and our own computer network. And nowadays we get that from cloud. So what we've done is really to shift our investment up to more differentiated services for the Spotify developers. So if, you know, to pick an example, observability for Spotify developers, making that really freaking easy. And like, you get out of the box instrumentation of your backend service. You get the type of monitoring and alerting that we want to have that is really well integrated, so that the idea for us is that, and you can do this, you can go into Backstage Resort, which is our developer portal that we use for pretty much everything, and you can go through a few clicks through a wizard of sort, and you end up with a service that is running in production in, like I did this just 2 days ago, and it takes maybe 2 minutes, and then you have your thing running in production. It's set up in our CI and CD, and it's registered in Backstage, the source code is in Git, like all of that is set up for you. That's where I think we see the value from our platform organization to come. And gradually, of course, more and more of that will move down into the into the things that we can get from our cloud provider or other providers. So it is it's a life cycle where more and more of those things over time move down and we move up. And that's been a gradual thing, everything Spotify started. So that's at least how we think about the positioning of our platform. And we can talk about how to build those platforms and build platform orgs if you're interested.
So I'm kind of interested, I guess, in where we draw the lines, where the boundary is between what represents the platform and what not. And I think part of the answer is one of the things that you said. I spoke in a previous episode with Gregor Hope, who currently at AWS, formerly at Google, who's working on part of this problem at AWS at the moment of how to better abstract the programming model for cloud-based services. And one of the things that Gregor and I kind of agreed on in our conversation was, and I don't know whether you would also see it this way, is that in order to define these clouds, you need to really deeply understand the business problems that you're trying to solve as well. You know, even when we're talking at levels of infrastructure, we've got to put this in the context of Spotify rather than generically just building cloud services, because otherwise, you know, Google or Amazon are doing that and presumably doing as good a job as you're likely to do internally. So you're bringing something else to the party in addition to that general kind of, for want of a better term, cloud operating system model level of services. I wondered whether you thought of it that way, and if so, what do you think the extra bits that you bring to the party are to make sure that your abstractions, your platforms better serve your needs rather than just solving the generic cloud problem?
Yes, I very much agree with that thinking. I should say there is some nuance to it. So once you get, at least it's been our experience, once you get to a certain amount of scale, for example, the economics will work out differently than they did before. So we've found that there are breaking points where some of the cloud products that we've been using for many, many years might not make financial sense for us, or might not scale to our, because we're such an outlier within the cloud environment in terms of usage. So even though that like layering model that I described before is very easy to reason about, like there's a general, like you said, like the cloud OS part that we can just use out of the box, and then we add our differentiation on top of that, and then we build our application on top of that. In reality, I would say that both of those layer boundaries, there's a lot of trade-offs going on there. We've made the decisions we've made has evolved over the years. Like all of a sudden it starts making sense for us to build our own, you know, caching service, because we're at a scale where we can't use the cloud provider anymore. Like just to pick an example. So just to nuance that picture a little bit, what we view as that middle layer that we really build on top of our cloud and that we want to provide for our app developers, there's a lot of integration in there, I would say. Like the pieces we get from our cloud environment are not necessarily fully integrated, so we have to patch them together a little bit, including with our proprietary pieces, of course.
Yeah.
And then it's exactly what you said, like the problem that Spotify wants to solve is not exactly the same problem as the next cloud customer wants to solve. So there is always that level of things that we can differentiate and make better for the type of problems that the Spotify developer is faced with that won't make sense for the Googles or Amazons necessarily to build. And over time, more and more of that will be generalized, but then we will move on to new areas to differentiate.
Yeah, Gregor talked about the difference between having a solution that was kind of, you know, built on an island or built on a boat, so that as the cloud services rise, your solution floats up on top, but sometimes the tide will overtake you and you'll need to, you know, get rid of your version and adopt the generic version that the cloud provider replaces with, or something like that, as services mature over time.
Yeah, I mean, a great example in our case, it's a little bit dated at this point, but and it's not very clearly differentiated, but I'll talk through it, because it's a good example of exactly what you just mentioned. So we built our own container orchestrator. So to, you know, deploy and scale and run our Docker infrastructure in our backend, we built that on our own called Helios. We open sourced it. Ironically, we open sourced it on the same conference and day before Kubernetes was open sourced. So we thought we were going to have our, you know, big day, and then we were quickly realized that here's a much better thing. So, but anyhow, so we've been running on that infrastructure for many years. But as Kubernetes came around, it got integrated and provided in the cloud environments. Like, we're on Google Cloud, so they have a very good offering with their managed Kubernetes products. And nowadays, we're just at the tail end of completely killing off our own container orchestrator. We still have some random workloads on there, but like, that's a great example of, like, now that's a problem we don't have to think about. We don't have to invest in building that anymore. We can build on top of what's provided in the cloud environment, and we can focus on, like, what's the next abstraction level for our developers. So that's exactly the, like, life cycle we want to see happening for us going forward.
So could you give us an example of something that your platforms give developers in higher level teams that they don't have to worry about anymore?
Yeah, so let me take another, it's a related but still another example. So and this actually goes all the way back to when we were in our own data center, so prior to 2016 or so, and before that. We were heavy users of Apache Cassandra as the main database that we used for all, pretty much all our production services, or large scale production services. And then as we moved into Google Cloud, into GCP, we gradually replaced Cassandra, which, again, we had big investments into being able to operate and run Cassandra at our scale. We were able to move that on top of Bigtable, which is Google's roughly similar type of database. And that meant that all of a sudden we could focus less on Cassandra and, like, running that. And now we were on top of a managed product. There's lots of complications that I'm skipping over here. It was not a super easy migration, but still. And that meant that the investment we have in a team on the storage side could move from, you know, building the infrastructure to spin up new Cassandra clusters to think about what's the API abstraction that we want our engineers to operate at. So that's what their focus is now. Like, what's a good API for developers? How can we integrate more of the needs that we have into that API? So a good example in our case, and I alluded to this before, because of our scale, we need to do a ton of caching just to be performant and cost effective. So what we've done is that we built in the caching layer into that abstraction as well. So now you get a storage abstraction, and you get just a knob that you turn, and you get your caching for free. So, like, that's the type of things that we can focus on rather than operating the more lower level infrastructure. This is just one example. You can apply this across the board pretty much.
It's a great example, but I'm kind of bouncing between the specific and the general, but bouncing back to the general again. So what we're really talking about, I suppose, is kind of identifying and implementing architectural layers of abstraction to hide detail, so we can provide rich services, but you don't need to know or care about them unless you really want to.
That's exactly right. Yeah. And to your point, like, there are definitely cases where you need to break through that abstraction because you have very specific needs, or maybe in our case, some of the services with the very highest load that we have, they might need some special treatment. But generally speaking, given we have thousands of services, we get a lot of bang for the bucks by improving the abstractions that we can provide to our developers.
Yeah. I want to wind back to an earlier part of the conversation. And I said that there were two things, and we've explored one, which was the platform engineering thing. The other part, in my terminology, I would talk about this as the continuous delivery problem. So what you're talking about is being able to automate a lot of the process of production and standardize is probably the wrong term, but regularize, make repeatable the steps in production. So could you talk a little bit about that aspect of the kind of fleet management and the platform management.
I realized I lost the thread on fleet management before, because I said I was going to take a step back and talk about the architecture, and here we are. So let me get back to that. Thanks for the prompt. So going back, we were at this point, we have thousands of software components. We think about them on an individual basis. And one way you can think about that is, imagine we now have to do some sort of technology migration. We need to move from Java 11 to Java 17, or someone changes an API in some library we use across the board. And now we have to ask hundreds of teams to change this in thousands of components, like on a case-by-case basis. And this was very tough. Like, engineers hated this. Like, we would have these migration programs. They would typically run for a year plus to do complete one of these migrations. And we could maybe manage like 5, 7, 10 at best during a year. So we were strictly bandwidth constrained on how fast we could evolve our infrastructure and just like keep it up to speed. And of course, the most extreme example of this is where you have a severe security vulnerability. You need to patch your entire production environment, maybe in a day. And that was always a huge scramble for us. Like, it would be like completely stop the business. Everyone heads down on patching Log4j or whatever it happened to be. So this was really where we realized we needed to improve, and we needed to shift our thinking from this like component by component, which again came naturally out of our strong ownership model and like the team autonomy stuff that we talked about before, to think about how can we operate our entire fleet of components as one thing. Can we apply mutations to the entire fleet, like thousands of components, rather than one by one? So this is what we call fleet management, the infrastructure we built for this, and the culture shift that it meant for us as an engineering organization. So maybe talk about those two things separately. I'll actually start with the culture part, because that's pretty interesting on its own. So I mentioned this before, and I mentioned a few times actually, that we had this and have this very strong ownership model. And that meant that you build, again, if we continue on the backend service example, you build your backend service and you operate it. You are on call for it. So you're going to be the one waking up in the middle of the night if it breaks.
So just to put terminology into your mouth that would be familiar to my listeners. So we'd be talking in terms of, you know, DevOps, continuous delivery, those sorts of ideas. You build it, you run it. It's that very strong sense of ownership.
That is exactly right. Yes. And the flip side of that, or the offering we gave to our teams in a way, was that you are in full control of that software. So you approve every change that goes into that software, because you're on call for it. That's how it worked. Yeah. And what we did when we started with the fleet management work was really to say, that is no longer going to be the case. Now we're going to have automation that is going to make changes to your software. We're going to roll that out and merge that into your software, possibly without you being in the loop. And that means that all of a sudden your test automation becomes absolutely critical, because it needs to catch the failure scenarios that can happen when we start making those types of automated changes.
Yeah.
And this, we imagined that this was going to be a huge culture shift for us, and it was going to lead to a fair amount of resistance in the engineering org. So we did a lot of preparations, you know, the usual change management type of activities that you go through. In the end, it turned out that engineer was like, oh, okay, this is fine, this works, and I'm super happy not to have to do this boring migration work. So still today, the most common support question we get on this topic is, these auto merges have stopped working for my service or my pipeline. Can you fix that to make sure I get these changes applied without me having to care about it? So, but it was, even though it ended up being a fairly simple transition, it was a pretty big transition for us still. And we needed to do a lot of work around, we had decent test automation, but there were definitely spots where we needed to improve that. And we needed to improve teams' ability to self-assess themselves. So we built out this, we call Soundcheck, which is now part of Backstage as well, which is the tool to self-assess how your software components are doing against the needs of like automating changes to them and whatnot. And then we built out the infrastructure parts of fleet management, which is really the tooling we have for authoring and orchestrating changes across our fleet. So what you can do now is that you can essentially write a code mod or a script that applies changes to an individual component, and then you can schedule that across thousands of components, and it gets rolled out and tested. And as long as the testing is green, we will potentially, we do this on a per change basis, but we might then auto-merge and auto-deploy those into production. So we now make thousands of changes every day based on this automation that gets rolled out in production.
So the strategy for that. So when you first started describing that, what was going through my head, I was thinking about the kind of, I suppose, low hanging fruit of kind of infrastructure as code kind of changes, because you'd mentioned upgrading Java and stuff like that. So that's one layer of those things. But I think you're talking about something else as well. So you're talking about upgrading the code in a component itself on an automated basis. So you've kind of got a delta change, so some kind of inspection of the code, and then an automatic change of the code in some way.
It is both of those, and we can maybe reason through them. I would say that we are not making very advanced code changes, but let me talk about the first part first, like the infrastructure as code, which is absolutely the case. So for all our cloud resources, for example, like we've talked about the databases and the blob storage buckets and whatever we have, those we manage through actually through Kubernetes as well. So they're defined as Kubernetes manifests. And that means that we can, of course, apply these types of changes to those as well. So we have, so we call each, so that I get the terminology right here up front, because I'm going to use this term, I think. We call each of these changes that we roll out, we call a fleet shift. So that's the term I'm sure I'm going to accidentally use if I don't define it. So we have fleet shifts that, for example, will make these changes to automate maybe resource usage from a cost perspective. So they will, you know, make sure that our Kubernetes autoscalers have sensible settings and whatnot. Like, and all of that gets applied. And that's obviously pretty easy. Like, it's fiddling around with YAML files, and it's mostly around figuring out what changes you need to do, more so than the authoring and orchestration of those changes. Another big piece for us has been to automate dependency updates. So every day we roll out new versions of the dependencies we use. So many people will be familiar with Dependabot and similar tools. And what we built is really the slightly more advanced version and more orchestrated version of that. So we can, well, I mentioned the Log4j incident before, and that was one example that we did roll out through fleet management. So we could deploy the fix for that and have that rolled out in our production fleet within a few hours just by doing this type of orchestration. So that's a lower level. And I would say by far, most of the changes we do is still within that layer. So if you look just quantifiably either at the number of fleet shifts or the number of pull requests that we send out, it's mostly in that layer. Mm-hmm. And then to get into your question, on top of that is making changes to the actual code. And we do that as well, but again, fairly simple changes. So it might be, you know, replacing an API call that's been deprecated, or we've done cleanups of Java imports, those types of things. So I would say we're still in a pretty nascent state, and that's one of the areas that we want to improve in. But it's pretty challenging, to be very honest about. We spoke a fair amount to our friends at Google as part of this, because they've done this for quite a few years, and has written some papers on it as well. So they spoke quite a bit on their learnings when it came to code changes, and the we're just going through the same set of learnings now of you have to, if you imagine like changing an entire API, you have to break that down into small changes that you can actually automate one by one. We use it to take a very concrete example. Like we've used it for, we're heavy users of Mockito, which is this mocking framework for Java. And Mockito has a tendency to break APIs at a semi-frequent basis. So we've used fleet shifts to automate those changes across, you know, hundreds or thousands of services, just to not have engineers have to bother with that type of work.
So could you kind of paint us a little bit of a picture, just to make this a bit more concrete, at least for me, in terms of, from a developer's point of view, if they want to implement one of these things, what's involved in describing, you know, coding something that can migrate an API in that way?
Yeah, so for Java code, which is where we've done most of these types of changes, there are frameworks for authoring these types of things. So there's a framework called Open Rewrite that I think came out of Netflix originally, I want to say, but now is there's a company spun up around it called Moderna. And so we use that framework. So it's a way of, you know, you get the abstract syntax tree of the code, and you can apply mutations to that. And the, there are more of these frameworks out there that can do this with for other languages and so on. It is still hard to make those changes. One thing I think you'll discover very quickly is, if you think about the programming language as an API in itself, it has an enormously wide API surface. So even for the most simple change of just, you know, replacing one method call with another method call because a method has been deprecated somewhere, the ways you can do, the many, many different ways you can do that in a programming language makes it surprisingly hard to author those types of changes. But anyhow, so that's typically what we do. We use one of those frameworks, or for more simple changes, you might be able to get away with doing some sort of regex replacement, or
Okay.
We have tooling for making more advanced changes to YAML or JSON files or things like that.
I'm sorry, I interrupted you, carry on.
Yeah, just to sort of quickly finish up what happens after that. So then that script gets packaged into a container, a Docker container. And that container is then deployed into our what's actually called FleetShift, which is our product, the internal product for this, or internal infrastructure for this. And you define, here's the container I want you to run, and here's the set of Git repositories that I want you to apply that change to. And that infrastructure will then basically check out all of those repositories one by one, run that Docker container against those, so that you basically get a Git diff on the other end of that. And that Git diff gets turned into a pull request that gets sent like a normal pull request to that component. And then for, again, some of these fleet shift, we then will apply what we call auto-merging. So the infrastructure will come around, check that the CI has worked, and it, if it has, it will merge that change and it will get deployed like any normal change. So that's usually how it works. There's more nuance to it, but that's a quick summary of how it works.
Interesting and very, very different to the kind of strategies that I would normally adopt myself or advise clients to adopt these days. So what would be your
preferred strategy? Just to
the other piece to that, I guess, is so. Try to use ideas like we were talking about before, platforms, abstraction in design, to identify more important points of isolation and think about the scope, the architectural scope of things, so that within a boundary, you're less worried about stuff changing or being up to date, and you can kind of up to date, at least for the stuff that makes me nervous in terms of the way that you're describing it, is that the code that you know, teams write that are talking to some third party piece of software without an abstraction. So I'd put a layer of abstraction between my code and that, and then work to the layer of abstraction. So I've got a more stable point for the change. But it's interestingly different.
I don't actually think it's different, but I 100% agree with what you're describing. That's exactly what we want to do as well. So we offer, like I mentioned, what we do for storage before, like we have our own abstraction for that. So teams are not faced with all the details of whatever the big table API might look like.
Yeah.
And we do the same. Internal service framework for the same thing. But the challenge is that even with, you won't get those abstractions 100% correct, and they will change over time. And we now have thousands of services that uses those abstractions. We need to evolve those over time. So you're still back to needing to have this type of solution. And I think when we talk to our peers in the industry, like, they all have some variant of this. Google most famously have their. So one thing that is maybe interesting to reflect on here as well is that I kind of alluded to this, but Spotify has a poly repo structure. So we have basically one component per repository. So when I say that we have a few thousand production services, that means that we have a few thousand repositories for those services.
Yeah.
That comes.
I was going to ask you about that because that's another of those trade-offs. It seems to be the scope of evaluation. And I think this gets us into the other really interesting part of what you've been describing, is talking about the testing strategy. So let's just talk about scope of evaluation. So it seems to me that you've got, that there's kind of a trade-off. You can accept greater levels of coupling within a scope of evaluation than you can accept between it. If you've got a component, two components in separate repos, there's a higher cost to validating that those components still work together than the same two components in a shared code base.
Yes, I think that's true. Although I would say, and I've said this a few times publicly, so I'm going to be embarrassed to say it again, but what we've found is that, what I should say is, we actually do very limited integration testing between different components. So
yeah,
if you imagine having this like enormous dependency graph of thousands of backend services all calling into each other, immediately you would need to think that you're going to have some, like, you know, consumer-driven contract testing or something like that in place. We have basically none of that in place, and we have very few cases where it breaks. And we do, going back to what we said before about having guardrails, we have a bunch of guardrails around how to design APIs and whatnot to minimize the risk of API breakages. But I remain surprised at how well it works with the limited amount of testing that we actually do in between components.
That's interesting. I agree with all that you said, and I'm intrigued by the last bit.
I am as well, to be honest.
Yeah. Classically, you know, what I'd say is that, you know, the microservices trade-off, you know, you keep things separate, you give teams autonomy, but you're not allowed to test all the pieces together because then you've lost all the benefits. You only get the costs. So you use techniques like contract testing to minimize that. But you need to be sure that you're not imposing change on other pieces. You're not forcing other pieces to change because you can't tell before you release. So what you're saying is that you found a course that isn't contract testing that does that. So what are these guide rails? Is this kind of sort of meta messaging, meta description of messaging or styles or something that allows that to work? It reminds me a bit of some researchy stuff that I did back in the early 90s. So I'm very intrigued about how this works.
I'm going to make you disappointed because it's nothing fancy. It's just, you know, we are heavy users of Protobuf, just as mentioned one thing. And Protobuf sets pretty good conventions and even nowadays enforces those conventions around optionality and default values and all of those stupid simple things that just goes into, say, an API design. And then we have, of course, in our internal documentation, some like recommendations around how to evolve your APIs, all of those types of things. But I'm going back to what I said before, even with that in place, I'm honestly surprised how well it works with the very limited testing we have. So what we do is that we, again, mostly talking about the services space here. We can talk about how we do this for data pipelines and mobile and whatnot. But in the services space, what we typically do is that each service has an integration test. But in that test, it will typically fake other services rather than spin those up. So you would not catch if you accidentally break an API when you make a change to your service. That would typically not be caught by test automation at Spotify. And we still have very, very few incidents where things break due to API changes. And again, I can't fully explain it, and I'm surprised myself that that's still the case, but it's been surprisingly effective for it. And it's I mean, the fact that we've never invested into contract testing, like we've done tests, of course, like we use Pact like everyone else for, yeah, for some domains and whatnot, but it's never become a wildly adopted things or thing or something that we've made any major investment into. And that's a strong sign that we've never seen the need for it. Like it's worked.
Yeah. It sounds to me that what you're describing is, to my old school brain, it sounds like an old school idea, which is that you want to be very specific about what you're publishing and very lenient about what you're subscribing to, yes, what you're listening, exactly, to.
Like, yeah, good old IP, yes.
So
there's a lot of, I'm simplifying things here. And of course, like there's a lot of thought that has gone into how we do API design and the protocols we use between services. Yeah. There's a lot of thinking into, you know, managing all the edge cases of, in particular, reliability and scalability concern. Yeah. But generally speaking, yeah, the loose coupling and strong conventions around API design has been,
yeah,
very effective.
Yeah, yeah, that does remind me of some stuff that I used to work on quite a lot. So getting back to the testing stuff. So it's a number of things that you've said during our conversation seem to be hinting at having a pretty robust, pretty strong culture of test automation and test approach at Spotify.
Yes.
So the stuff that you were just describing in terms of testing individual services, I would call that service level acceptance testing. You're testing the behavioral impact of a service. You're defining the behavioral impact of a service through those tests, and then presumably you're doing other things. Could you just talk a little bit more broadly about how you see the approach to testing and the evaluation of those things?
Sure. Yeah.
Sorry, I've just started some music somehow. Let me just shut that off.
We're Spotify, so we enjoy music, so that's fine. I'm not sure. Well, let's discuss if this is acceptance testing or not by some definition. But so what I would say is that we have, and again, all of this is based on the individual component level, or we group a few logical components together into what we call a system. So we have these like well-defined terms that we use internally. So you can imagine our playlists, our the backend services that service playlists of Spotify. There's actually quite a few, like there's maybe 10 or so backend services that together serve the playlist experience. So each of those is defined as a component or a service. And then we group those together into a system. And we typically do very good testing on the component level. I'll talk through the different layers of that. And in some cases, we also test on the system levels. We might actually spin up a few closely related services as containers, yeah, and test that they work together.
Let me just interrupt you for a minute, just winding back to something you said right at the beginning of the conversation, which is, I think that, you know, the rate at which the number of services is growing faster than the rate at which the number of developers are growing. So presumably you're also, developers are associated with clusters of services in the way that you're just describing now. Yes.
Yes. Yeah. So cool. Going back to what we talked about around ownership. So
yeah,
one of those, each component is owned by a single team, and actually this grouping of systems is owned by a single team as well. So yeah, there's a playlist team that owns that playlist system. So that's the thinking, like that's the level of ownership that we have. And then we actually group, yeah, systems into domains, going back to you mentioned, yeah, Derek Evans. So yes, we group those into domains which are larger and are not owned by a single team.
Yeah,
so going back to testing. So if you look at the component level, and again, we're talking about backend services here, but you can apply this equally well to, you know, our micro websites or our data pipelines or mobile components or whatnot. I would say that the testing within the component is typically on a pretty good level. We have your normal unit testing, and we have often some level of integration testing, where we might, in the like typical unit testing format, test integrations with maybe faked other services and whatnot. And then we typically have what we call a container test, which is in the Java world using typically a test containers framework, where we package up the final service, the same container image that we're going to deploy into production, and we actually test that together with either faked out services and or the resources that that component needs. So that might be, I mentioned that we use Bigtable before, so we might spin up a Bigtable emulator to test that the service can actually work together with its database, for example. And that's typically the testing we do. And then we don't have, one thing that is maybe important to note is that for the vast majority of our software, we do not have a staging environment, but we, as soon as something is merged, like gone through that automated testing, it gets deployed into production. Typically in our case, we use Canary deployments. We will deploy one or maybe a few instances and then have automation monitoring that. And if everything looks good with the core metrics that we look at, we will automatically progress that deployment. So that's typically what the pipeline looks like for us.
Yeah.
There are exceptions where we have regulatory requirements or where we have integrations with third parties that do require a staging alignment. So then we use that, but it's very small in terms of the overall fleet that we have.
I guess the other question there is what's the scope of the piece of work that an individual developer is doing? Are teams working on the basis of trunk-based development, sort of full-blown continuous integration, all the way, you know, all the way into production, rather than feature branching, for example?
So for there's nuance on the mobile side because of how app stores and that whole thing works, but on everything else, it's all trunk-based. So you make your PR, you get that merged, and then it goes straight into production.
Cool. So
we do something in the neighborhood of 3,000 deployments per day into our production environment.
And presumably with very low failure rates. You've already mentioned that you see that. I guess the other part of this is observability and how you detect. So on those occasions where you do get a breakdown in the comms between two pieces, how do you know?
So we have, I mentioned this briefly earlier, but we have a lot of instrumentation. So from each backend service, we collect hundreds of different metrics, and those goes into standardized templates that we use both for, you know, the visual type of monitoring that you as a developer can use. So we use Grafana, so like you can go in and watch your service and whatever way it behaves. And that goes into alerting for triggering like an incident with developers. Mm-hmm. When it comes to fleet management, I should also add that since we're doing these orchestrated rollouts of a change across the fleet, we also monitor those. So we see that the failure rate of those as they both are applied. So the PR, like, are we getting green builds from the PR? And then the failure rate once they get deployed, we monitor both of those so we can abort rollouts quickly if we need to.
Do you automate the pulling of rollouts, or is that a manual decision?
It is still a manual decision. It's something that we potentially will aim to automate in the future, but so far it's been so infrequent that we need to stop rollout. So we haven't opted to invest into it yet, but it does happen. We actually had one that failed yesterday or the day before yesterday because of a third party API breaking change. So those do happen. And it might be something that maybe won't automate the full rollout, but we might automate the pausing of the rollout. So, you know.
So do you do things like canary releasing? Sorry, I interrupted you again.
Yeah, sorry. So like we might pause the rollout just in automated ways so that we don't deploy more broken things. That might be the first step.
So from that, I assume that you kind of do canary releasing where you roll out progressively to more and more environments. Yeah,
that's exactly right. And we have automation for that as well. It's not fully adopted yet, so we're still in the in the rollout of that automation. But yeah, that's exactly how we monitor things.
Yeah, so I think Netflix do the canary index thing where they define each of the releases effectively as an experiment and use the measurement of the metric to determine whether to roll back or continue the rollout.
Yep, I think Netflix has a slightly different deployment strategy than we do, but in the end, I think the effect is the same. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. It's fascinating talking to you and the, you know, representing one of the, if you'll forgive me using the term, the web monster kind of companies. There's such a lot to learn from organizations like yours. But one of the pushbacks that I get as when I'm working with clients and stuff is, yes, but we're not Spotify, or yes, but we're not Google or whatever. And, you know, they get all of these great people, and so they can do these amazing things. And, you know, we don't do that. So I'm interested in how you see the kind of the cultural aspects of development in these terms. So how do you see the role of experience, skill, and expertise? And how do you build a culture of successful development and bring people on board into what's inevitably, for an organization like yours, a unique environment?
Yes, I'll only be able to speak from my own experience. So to set that in context a little bit, I've been at Spotify for 12-ish years at this point. And prior to that, I worked in as a consultant, and I worked in the more traditional industrial companies. So I'm based in Gothenburg. I worked a lot at the Volvo companies that are based here, for example. So that's what I can compare with. I cannot really, I have a lot of friends and work closely with the Google and the Metas and the Amazons, but I can't really like deeply compare with them. So I'll speak to my reflections on that. And I talk to many other companies on a frequent basis. I have a reasonable understanding, but I would say, first of all, that Spotify, and I think many of our peers, like we mentioned Netflix and the big ones that I just named a few seconds ago, I think the thing that they share is really being this, having this very strong, like in the engineering culture going through the company. So I can go talk to Daniel, who's our CEO, and he will have a very good understanding of how engineering works and value engineering very highly. And I think that's, at least for me, has been very different from my experience working in maybe the little bit more traditional companies. And I think that creates a very different culture and a different empowerment maybe for how to think about engineering and engineering practices that might be hard to replicate if you don't have, like, I think it's going to be very hard to build that into your culture if you don't have, like, we've never had to build that into our culture because it came naturally with how the company started. Like, it started, I did not join at the very beginning, but like it started in that, with that culture. And I think it's super hard to introduce that later on. But I do think there are bits and pieces that you can definitely learn. Like some of the practices that we use, like I talked about the deployment strategy we have, like all of that, I think you can more or less try to replicate within your company. And going back to your question, like, yes, it's certainly true that not every company needs to be a Spotify, and Spotify doesn't have to be a Google that is like 20x our size or whatever. So you have to pick the things that make sense for you and for your context. It's also worth remembering that Spotify is not in a very regulated business. We're not in a business with very high stakes. Like, the worst that can happen for us is that people can't listen to their favorite music for a while. It's not, we're not running a nuclear plant. Like the,
oh, podcast.
yes, that is very true. Or podcast. So you have to take that context into consideration. Like, if I just talked about our lack of contract testing before, like if you run a nuclear plant, I'm sure you're going to want to have much more verification than we might want to have. So that, all of that being said, like, I do think that there's a lot of practices that like Spotify did not invent, but we're heavy users of, that other companies can definitely learn from and apply and get huge benefits from.
Let's say that you have a new starter. How does that new starter learn the ropes, learn to work your way?
Yeah, so one, I would say the there's one meta way of trying to answer that question. Then there's the very concrete way. So I'll start with the meta way. And that is really the things that we've talked about today of having a fairly similar looking type of infrastructure, having a shared infrastructure platform that everyone uses, and trying to make that platform great, like make it a really good product, and which is hard, but like we're far from perfect, but that's the aim. Like we always want to simplify, make it easier to use and onboard, and not just onboard, but also move in between in within the org or move to a different discipline. Like I used to be a backend developer, now I want to learn machine learning or whatever. So that's the meta aspect. And I think that's always been part of our culture since day one, to like, we think we're going to be growing as a company, so we need to make these things relatively easy. And then to talk more concretely, so one of the things that we do that I think has been maybe the single most powerful thing for us is that we have these things called golden paths. And I think most of our peer companies have something like this today. So it's basically a lengthy tutorial on how to build something at Spotify. So there's a golden path for backend, there's a golden path for data, for machine learning, for mobile development and whatnot. And it's essentially it used to be a long Google Doc. Now it's a long backstage thingy where you go through the various steps of, you know, creating a backend service, connecting that to Bigtable, setting up your monitoring, operating that service. All of that is you can step through. And part of starting at Spotify is that you go through a small boot camp where you get to talk to a bunch of other people at Spotify and listen to people like myself drone on about what we do at Spotify. And then you go through at least one of the golden paths for whatever discipline you're going to be focusing on. Typically, you will go through maybe one or two or three of them. And that's been, for us, been a very effective way of getting people up to speed on the basic stuff. And then at least at Spotify, you, part of starting, you get assigned to a squad. So you end up in a team that is delivering on something. You get a buddy in that squad and you start working. Like one of the core metrics that we measure is the onboarding time for new engineers. So basically the time from you being hired to you having shipped a certain number of changes into production. Like that's one of the core KPIs that we measure and we try to reduce over time. So right now we're not growing quickly, so now this is a less crucial metric for us, but when we were in a heavy growth stage, we tracked this very, very closely.
And did you do things like pair programming or mentorship schemes to help bring people on as well? It's another thing that I've seen work well for some of those sorts of things.
We do some amount of both pair programming and mob programming, but it happens pretty organically wherever they want to do that. I wouldn't say that it's very deeply built into our culture or something that we tell people explicitly to do, but I would say it's become more and more popular organically and definitely happens. I would say it probably happens. I don't actually know if this is true. I'm going to be speculating here a little bit. I think it more commonly happens as part of developing something new rather than as an onboarding activity, but I might be wrong there. I'm not sure that that's entirely true.
Yeah, interesting. It's one of the side benefits that I've always seen with pair programming is that stabilizing effect of team culture as a way of using it as a tool to kind of, you know, grow the team culture and spread it.
Yeah, I've been at companies previously that were very heavy adopters of pair programming, and were even in cases enforcing it. And I wouldn't say that was a bad thing, but I'm also not completely bought into that is something you have to do. Like I think we could arguably do more of it at Spotify, both parent mob programming, but I also think it is a tool to apply where it makes sense rather than apply across the board.
Sure. I think we're coming up to our time, and before I wrap up, I just want to make sure that there's nothing else that you think we should have talked about that we haven't talked about yet.
No, I think we covered a lot of ground. It was a fun discussion.
It was. I've enjoyed myself.
Meandered a little bit between different topics, but I think that was fun for me at least. I hope it's useful for whoever will listen to this as well.
I hope so too. The meandering is almost entirely my fault. It's the fault of the way that I think about things. So sorry about that. But yeah, it's been delightful having the conversation and fascinating to get some insight into this. I like the idea of fleet management. The words that you use are different to the words that I would use for some of these things. But I think that the concepts align very well with the way that I think about the problems and so on, which is always interesting. This kind of issue of convergent evolution for an organization like yours facing rapid growth and complex technical problems in an interesting domain. There are forces that push you in towards better engineering disciplines, to my mind.
Yeah, I should to actually go back to your question on what we missed. So I should at least mention that we have, if people are interested in more deeply interested in fleet management specifically, we published a 3-blog post series on our fleet management work. So there's a first post that I wrote on the overall strategy, largely what we talked about today, and then there are two more in detail posts on how we do infrastructure as code, and then how the fleet shift stuff that I talked about works. I would, if you're interested in that, I would highly recommend go read those. They're maybe a year or two old by now, but they're mostly still valid. So yeah, they are.
We'll put links to those things in the description to the podcast. Perfect. Thank you.
Yeah.
I'd also mention the backstage thing that you mentioned, which I think Spotify is open sourced as a kind of platform for developer experience, I suppose.
Yeah, so that's absolutely true. Yeah, so Backstage is, I mentioned that before, but that's our internal, what started out as our internal developer platform. It's become insanely powerful within Spotify. Like, as a developer, that's where you spend a lot of your time doing when you do your work. And we've open sourced the Backstage. Is very, very, very plugin based. So I think internally we have something like 200 different plugins that powers our internal Backstage. So we've open sourced the core part of that. That is a very active CNCF project nowadays. And then on top of that, we offer a bunch of plugins. Some of those plugins are open source, and some of those plugins we offer as a commercial offering. So I mentioned, for example, I mentioned Soundcheck earlier on, which is this tool we use for self-assessment. So that's part of our commercial bundle. If people are interested, you can go read about
it. My take on reading about that, about Backstage, was it's kind of a platform for the formalization of tactical automation for your development approach. Do you think that's a reasonable description?
Yeah, that's at least one aspect of it that I think is a very important. So let me spin off for a second on Backstage. I'm not a salesperson, so I'm not going to do this, the Backstage sales pitch here, but the way I think about Backstage, there's really three things to it. There's, at the core, it's the software catalog. It's where your catalog of all the software that you have at your company. So in Spotify's case, that's the thousands of components that we talked about in this discussion. They're all registered in Backstage. Each of them has their own page where you can go read who's the owner for the playlist service, where is it deployed, how's it doing, what's the monitoring look like, all of those things. So that's like the core of it. And then on top of that, or based on that catalog, you have all of these plugins that then provide different functionality around that, your software. So at Spotify, if you want to go change the deployment of a service, you go into Backstage and you can see for that service all the versions that are available, and you can choose which one should be deployed, all of those types of things. And then third, it's really, for us, has become the central information hub for everything. So all our documentation nowadays is in Markdown in Git, and that gets rendered. So you can go into Backstage, and when I when I want to search for an API or I want to search for how does this thing works, I will immediately go into Backstage and I will search for that because that's where all the documentation is sort of centralized. So that's the three like central tenets that I think about that Backstage offers for Spotify at least.
That's great. Thank you. And we'll put links to that in the description as well. Cool. So let me just wrap up first by saying thank you very much to Nicholas for taking part today. It's been an absolute pleasure and fascinating to gain some insights into the way that Spotify works. So thank you, Nicholas. It's been great.
Thanks. It's been a great discussion. It was really, like I said, it was fun. It got broader than I expected. I had in my head was thinking about I'm going to talk for an hour about fleet management, but we really went much broader than that, and I enjoyed that, so that was good.
Yeah, great fun. Thank you. I'd also say thank you once again to Equal Experts for sponsoring the episode today and the series in general, and thank you to the listeners for being our audience. These discussions are aimed at helping us all to push our discipline forward. If we've helped to change your perspective on the things that we discussed here today, please do leave the podcast a review, as it will help us a lot to reach a wider audience with our show. Also, let us know on Twitter or other social media channels if you've got suggestions for guests that we really should talk to. Similarly, if you have any thoughts on our discussion here today, please do let us know. The best way to get in contact with us is through our Discord, which you can access via Patreon. So if you enjoyed this episode today, please do consider supporting the show, either directly through Patreon or by leaving us a review. Thank you very much indeed, and bye-bye.